Bresta in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
With the New York Times in one hand and the Catechism of the Catholic Church in the other, Al Cresta is ready for conversations of consequence.
America is as divided as it has been in 150 years.
Politics is symptomatic of the culture.
They don't have a personal relationship with Christ.
We've been sacramentalized, but not evangelized.
Why should Washington listen to us when our own house is in disarray?
The church's greatest riches are her people.
Share the contagious joy of being a friend of Christ.
Story after story after story. Story of people who have had inexplicable healings.
Broadcasting from the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and taking a closer Catholic look at current events, issues, and ideas. This is Cresta in the Afternoon.
That's beautifully said, Al.
Thanks for your voice for liberty.
It's like a homecoming each time on your program.
Clear to me that you've thought these things through at a deep level.
Let's build the church, and then we'll bless the nations. And a good afternoon to you. I'm Al Cresta. Thank you for joining me, building the church, blessing the nations. This is a great time to be Catholic in America. You know by that I'm not ignoring the problems we face. In fact, I have to tell you, as troubling as it is sometimes, who would you rather have dealing with these problems than you? Christ has called you to engage the issues of the gospel in this generation. Not last generation, not the coming generation, but right now. We try to do it here on this program and everything that's produced by EWTN and Ave Maria Radio. So today, we are in fact looking at human rights and natural law. The State Department has just announced, well, actually earlier this month, a new human rights commission led by former ambassador to the Vatican, Marianne Glendon. And people are criticizing it, because they're going to try to restore the foundation of human rights and human dignity, natural law. This has been a standard foundation for understanding human dignity. But there are problems among the academic elite, and we're going to talk about those problems with Dan Philpott, University of Notre Dame. He'll be giving us his impression of this project. We're also going to talk with Angela Dills this hour. Dr. Dills is an economist. You know, we had a lot of conversation about the gender wage gap. It's been heightened because of the conversation surrounding the U.S. women's soccer team. They get paid less than the men's soccer team, but they're more successful. But exactly what does success mean when it comes to economics? We're going to talk that over with Dr. Dills. We're also going to talk with Dr. Eduardo Echevarria about this terrible document, the working document for the Amazon Synod scheduled for the fall. And we'll also take a look at the present economy with George Schwartz of Schwartz Investment Counsel, Inc. and the Ave Maria Mutual Funds, one of our sponsors here on Cresta in the Afternoon. But first, it's to the headlines.
Thanks, Al. Good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Monday, July 15th. It's the Feast of St. Bonaventure. Today's news is brought to you by the Ave Maria Family of Funds at AveMariaFunds.com. President Trump is unapologetic about what some call his racially charged attacks on four congressional Democrats. Speaking at the White House today, Trump said they're angry all the time and should leave the U.S. if they're so unhappy. Trump called the four freshman congresswomen, who are all women of color, socialists, and said they hate the U.S. and Israel. The backlash was fueled by Trump's remark that the four women should go back to their countries and fix things there. Three of the four were born in the United States. Power company Con Edison is warning that there could be more blackouts in New York City as a heat wave heads for the city. Meantime, Con Ed chief spokesman Mike Clendenin says they're still trying to figure out what led to this weekend's blackout.
We know what equipment went out. We know what breakers opened. We know all those things. We know exactly what happened. We want to get to the more root cause as to why, and that's what everybody wants to get to, and we will.
Con Ed admits its engineers still have no idea what caused Saturday's outage that left 73,000 people without power in Manhattan. Tropical Depression Barry may bring possible flooding to parts of the lower Mississippi and Ohio Valley this week. The storm is currently centered over Arkansas, but the rain is still falling upon parts of Mississippi and Louisiana. Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin is pushing Congress to raise the federal debt ceiling before the August recess. Speaking at the White House today, Mnuchin says he doesn't see a possible government shutdown looming. He stressed that there's no sentiment among lawmakers to put the full faith and the credit of the U.S. at risk. Mnuchin has warned that the debt ceiling could be breached in September. Congressional leaders would also like to hammer out a new annual budget deal before August. I'm Steve Clark, Ave Maria, Radio News.
Dude, I'm Al Cresta. I thank you for joining me. On July 8th, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo launched a commission on inalienable or unalienable human rights. He charged the commission with the task of rethinking the foundation of human rights. Why? Well, because we have gross violations of human dignity and human rights that are continuing throughout the world. And sometimes they're even in the name of human rights. International institutions designed and built to protect human rights often drift from their original mission. When I heard this, that they were going to be assembling this new commission, I went back and looked at President Bush's Bioethics Commission. Again, they had a different task. But it resembled, in terms of its significance, it resembled what I think President Trump is trying to accomplish through Secretary of State Pompeo. Now, as I mentioned before, Marianne Glendon, the former Vatican ambassador to the Vatican, is going to be heading up this new commission. And they will be doing practical things, but they'll also be thinking, and that's important. President Bush's Bioethics Commission was headed up by Dr. Leon Cass, Dr. Edmund Pellegrino, and included such stalwarts as Marianne Glendon, Dr. Ben Carson, Dr. Michael Sandel of Harvard, Charles Krauthammer, Dr. Paul McHugh of Johns Hopkins, Robert George from Princeton. And they published a tremendous amount, a surprising amount for a government commission. And of course, there are people who didn't like that. They didn't think that a presidential commission should be engaged in such philosophical thinking. In fact, when President Obama came to office, he informed the members of the Bioethics Commission that he intended to replace them. And he wanted a body that would, quote, offer practical policy options rather than philosophical guidance. And then there were critics of President Bush's Bioethics Commission. They said that the president was just finding people to back his positions on stem cell research and abortion. But by the way, I should mention that there are, I know a number of the members of that commission, that Bioethics Commission, they did not have the same position on stem cell research as President Bush did. So I think that's just a false statement. But they were, again, the critics of the President Bush's Bioethics Commission said that it's political. They have a political and religious agenda. They are trying to disguise their politics by talking about human dignity. And so the President Obama decided to disband the council. I thought it was a mistake. I thought we lost a real think tank there. But now we have another issue coming up. It's not bioethics this time. It's simply the ethics surrounding torture, the ethics surrounding genocide, the ethics surrounding the treatment of others across the globe. And so we've got a new commission the Secretary of State has launched on inalienable rights. Basically, what can we say about the dignity of the human person? And it's hard to imagine, in fact, any notion of a decent politics or a decent nation that doesn't depend on the notion of the dignity of the human person. Marianne Glendon, by the way, who's going to be heading up this commission, has been thinking about these things for a long time. I just came across an article of hers in a 2011 issue of First Things magazine in which she said, "It's unfortunately very hard to specify how to anchor the notion of human dignity in something beyond our most earnest moral intuitions." In fact, bioethicist Adam Shulman said the question of human dignity Well, the question is whether it's useful or not. Is it a mere slogan that camouflages unconvincing arguments? The problem is that when you lose the confidence that human dignity refers to something real, what do you replace it with? After the Second World War, the United Nations was started, and they came up with the UN Charter, the Declaration on Human Rights. And those who contributed to that declaration could not agree on the philosophy behind human rights and human dignity. But they were able to largely agree on what those fundamental human rights were. And that problem, by the way, has never been solved internationally. There is still no universally agreed upon basis for defending the concept of human dignity. Basically, the establishment of the UN Declaration of Human Rights was an act of faith. It was an act of faith after an especially brutal war that was marked by unprecedented atrocities. And, in fact, political realists following the Second World War, when they looked at the UN Declaration on Human Rights, they actually thought it was astonishingly naive. Nevertheless, this concept of human dignity was made central to the constitutions and rights declarations all around the world in the late 20th century. So it was fruitful. People followed it. People began to, in other countries, non-European countries even, began to use the concept of human dignity to help ground the protection of human rights. Now, for Catholics, this is important because if you want to have one concept to summarize Catholic social doctrine, it is the dignity of the human person. Everything else flows from that. Catholic social doctrine, sometimes people think, is really complicated. No, it's not. It's actually fairly simple. Applying it is complicated. But Catholic social doctrine isn't that difficult. Its bedrock is human dignity. We believe human beings are made in the image and likeness of God, that they have eternal worth. Now, let me point out that we have an intellectual history to this conversation. Before World War II, nobody expected human dignity to become as important as it now is. In fact, Max Weber, the great sociologist of his generation, arguably the greatest, I mean, he's up there in the top two or three, he argued that the world had become, quote, disenchanted. By that, he simply meant that it's no longer ruled by mysterious, unpredictable forces. On the contrary, in principle, we can control everything by means of calculation. And so that means the disenchantment of the world. You don't need magical means in order to control things. You don't have to pray to the spirits as did the savage for whom such mysterious powers existed. Instead, we've got technology and calculation to achieve our ends. This was of great faith in science, and it dominated between the two wars. It actually was very big before the First World War, and they didn't learn much from the First World War. So this faith in science continued in the time between the two world wars. And it led to the rise of social Darwinism. It led to the eugenics movement and eventually led to the German euthanasia program and eventually to the Final Solution, which was the industrial strength application of eliminating a disadvantaged race. That's the way it was thought. Racial science was very big in Nazi Germany. In fact, there was a very big case here in the United States called Buck versus Bell. It was about involuntary sterilization of the imbecile, the great Oliver Wendell Holmes, celebrated jurist, one of the great Supreme Court justices. He said, "I see no reason for attributing to man a significance different in kind from that which belongs to a baboon or a grain of sand. The sacredness of human life is purely magical. It's no validity outside, the wish of those presenting it. The only possibility," he thought, "for human improvement would be some process of breeding a selected race. Now, that's not Nazi genetics we're talking here. We're talking about one of the most celebrated jurists in the history of the U.S. Supreme Court. He believed, again, progress could only come about by breeding a selected race. And he imported that view right into the Supreme Court decision of Buck versus Bell, in which he said, it is better for all the world, instead of waiting to execute degenerate offspring for crime or to let them starve for their imbecility, society can prevent those who are manifestly unfit from continuing their kind. Three generations of imbeciles are enough. And with that decision, the U.S. Supreme Court said that those imbeciles, if you will, could be involuntarily sterilized. In this case, it was a woman named Carrie Buck. And in fact, who failed Carrie Buck here in the United States? This is before the Holocaust, by the way. Who failed her? Well, America's academic community failed her. America's legal community failed her. America's medical community failed her. And America's judiciary failed her. We forget these things. When the concept of human dignity is lost and is replaced by calculation, we are all vulnerable. So the U.S. went on, by the way, to involuntarily sterilize at least 60,000. And then the Second World War came about, and we had the Holocaust. And we were chagrined. We were humiliated. We were brought low by the judgment of God. And ended up having to rethink how we protect human dignity. And that's what gave rise to the UN Declaration on Human Rights. It's why scholars, activists, thinkers were all able to get together and come up with protecting the dignity of the human person. The Catholic Church had a significant role to play, not directly, but through people like Jacques Maritain, the Catholic philosopher. We are now at a point where the concept of human dignity seems to have run out of fuel, and we are back to seeing those who believe it can be replaced by a scientific definition of the human person. Well, hopefully, the Secretary of State, Pompeo, and this Human Rights Commission with Marianne Glendon will be able to restore the natural law basis for human dignity and move the discussion onto secure ground once again.
We recently prevailed in a lawsuit filed in an Oklahoma federal court by Raja E. Fatia, a Muslim and a board member of CARE Oklahoma, against Chad and Nicole Neal, the owners of an Oklahoma gun range. Fatia was represented by lawyers from CARE, the ACLU, and a large New York law firm, the usual suspects. The American Freedom Law Center represented the Neals. The controversy arose when in 2015, Fatia entered the Neals gun range armed with a loaded military-issue handgun strapped to his side, a military-style rifle slung over his shoulder, magazines loaded with approximately 140 rounds of 9mm ammunition, a concealed recording device in his pocket, and a dangerous agenda. To create a controversy with armed individuals at the gun range, hoping that he would not be allowed to fire his weapons so he could file this meritless lawsuit and run to the media with his prearranged Islamophobia narrative, knowing that the liberal media would willingly serve as an echo chamber for his spurious claim of discrimination. CARE's lawsuit was dismissed with prejudice. CARE's extremely reckless and dangerous attempt to set up a lawsuit to make a political point has failed. Apparently, CARE and the ACLU didn't want to put CARE's nefarious ties to terrorism on trial, so they caved in. And in the end, the good guys won yet again. I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel for the American Freedom Law Center, bringing you this Faith and Freedom Minute. You can learn more about the American Freedom Law Center and its fight for your faith and freedom by visiting our website and liking us on Facebook.
What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
I don't understand why I have to earn salvation.
How is it possible that God created everything?
Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest?
Why is the Catholic Church so unwilling to
The Catholic Church is too rich.
Catholics worship Mary and are committed.
As far as I'm concerned, all religions are equal.
You are called to communion with Dr. David Anders. Tonight, 11 p.m. Eastern on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
The leading Catholic voices are on EWTN Radio.
We do our best to keep you, well, connected to all the events happening in our one holy Catholic and apostolic faith, from Rome to back home here in the U.S. and around the globe. It's also our goal to help each and every listener like you take this beautiful faith of ours out into the public square with great ideas on making a difference through engaging the culture.
Catholic Connection with Teresa Tomeo, tomorrow morning, 9 Eastern, on EWTN Radio.
Ciao, Sorelli and Fratelli, sisters and brothers. Teresa Tomeo here from Catholic Connection. Through the years, so many of you have contacted me asking for my advice on traveling to my favorite place in the world, Italy. Being that I've had the blessing of visiting the country more than 50 times now, I've decided to respond to those special requests by introducing Tease Italy at TravelItalyExpert.com, a website for all things Italia where you'll receive insider tips on where to eat, stay, shop, play, and most importantly, pray. At TravelItalyExpert.com, you'll discover, with the help of our key partners, Ave Maria Radio and Corporate Travel, this beautiful Catholic country through videos, blogs, and even personal travel consulting. So whether you're planning that upcoming visit or just want to learn more about Italy, connect with me on TravelItalyExpert.com. Ciao for now. We'll see you online at Tease Italy, TravelItalyExpert.com.
Beth, why is our health insurance so expensive? Our premium and deductible are so high. Plus, I don't want my family to support a company that doesn't share our values.
Kim, there is another option. Check out CMF Curo. It's an affordable Catholic healthcare ministry where members share their medical costs in community, and it's pro-life. We joined last year and have saved thousands, all without compromising our values. Just go to MyCatholicHealthcare.com.
CMF Curo sounds exactly like what our family needs.
Yeah, that's MyCatholicHealthcare.com.
Good afternoon, I'm Al Cresta. Last week, I mentioned that there's a new human rights commission being led by former ambassador to the Vatican, Marianne Glendon. This, again, is in conjunction with the State Department. And some people have complained that it's, quote, promoting natural law, which some people think is a way of denying access to abortion or undermining LGBT, whatever other letters get in there, rights. With me right now to talk about this new initiative and how natural law plays into our confidence in human rights is Dr. Daniel Philpott. He's professor of political science at the University of Notre Dame. His research focuses on religion and global politics, emphasizing reconciliation and religious freedom. You can visit his work at arcoftheuniverse.info. Dan, good to have you back here.
Great to be with you again, Al. Hello.
Hi. Let me take a look at this. Is this a new initiative on the State Department's? In other words, are they launching, creating a new department, or is this replacing something that was already there?
Now, this looks like an advisory body that will be in addition to the kind of permanent office and permanent architecture of human rights in the State Department. It looks like the Secretary of State has some concerns about human rights and is putting together a commission of mostly intellectuals, but also some activists and politicians and so forth, to kind of think about human rights and advise him on human rights, with the idea that some new directions and changes are needed in the promotion of human rights.
So is this group rethinking the foundations of human rights, and is that something we can expect a more philosophic approach to things, or is this an activist or wing?
Well, it's yet to be defined. It looks like it may be something like, again, I'm not entirely sure, and I think it still has yet to take shape, but it may be something like the Council on Bioethics,
right,
that George W. Bush established, where he said, look, we need some thinking on this. I don't know what to do about this,
right,
issue here. We need some thinking. I'm going to put together a little bit of a brain trust, people to help me to kind of work through this. And I do think that the secretary is concerned about the foundations of human rights, but he's also concerned about the way that human rights is pursued by the human rights community, with the idea that that has gotten away from its
yes,
true foundations.
That's right. Yeah, when President Obama came in, he basically decommissioned that bioethics council, claiming at the time, as if I recall, that he didn't need anything that philosophical. So I thought that, you know, that was headed up by Leon Cass. Robert George was on it.
Yes. They were, and a remarkable body, in
it
fact.
Was.
I think it did great work. Yeah,
I agree. Okay, so now Marianne Glendon is a Catholic. She's well-respected in the academic world. She led the Vatican's contingent to the Beijing Women's Conference. She's, really an outstanding person. She attended the Under Caesar's Sword conference in Rome. So
this is
somebody who really knows how human rights are grounded. Will she be a champion of natural law?
Well, I would think so, given her commitments. And she has been one of the foremost kind of interpreters and activists of human rights in the past generation, certainly from a Catholic perspective, or and anyone who subscribes to natural law can really look to her as being a kind of standard bearer for all that is good in human rights. And the other people on the commission also are just first-rate blue chippers. So the content of the makeup of the commission looks very strong.
Who are some of the other names on it?
Well, there's Chris Tollefson, not as well known, but from the University of South Carolina, also an outstanding first-rate natural law scholar. There's Jackie Rivers, who is kind of a scholar and activist of issues, many related to the African-American community.
Mm-hmm.
There's Meyer Soloveitchik, a prominent Jewish leader. There's Hamza Yousaf, who one of the most prominent Muslim voices in the U.S., but all basically on the right page when it comes to natural law and the kind of foundations of truth that human rights need.
Why is a natural law foundation important? For people who really don't think much about these matters, what is natural law and why is it so important?
Well, I would say most centrally what is needed is the truth about the human person and about moral norms. That, you know, the human rights movement got going after World War II. It was a response to World War II and the atrocities there. But his idea to say that there are some things that you just can't do to anyone, no matter what your regime is, what your cause is, how exigent you think the security situation your regime is focusing on. And if these norms and rights are not grounded in truth, something kind of enduring and unalterable about the human person, and a truth about human dignity and human goods and human norms, then I think they're going to be very difficult to defend, particularly when they come under great pressure from this or that regime or this or that culture who wants to say, no, something else is more important. That this is a luxury we can't afford. We've got to say, no, these are truths about the human person that nobody can override. And natural law is, I would say, the best way of accessing those truths or of thinking about those truths.
So the Second World War and the Holocaust forced thinking men and women around the globe to ask what was the basis for our condemnation of Nazi behavior. The Nazis themselves and those who were at the Nuremberg trial claimed that the nations of the world didn't have any basis to convict them other than mere fact that they won. And so the nations of the West, formed by a Judeo-Christian understanding of things, said, no, we're holding you guilty here, not simply because we won, but because what you did was reprehensible and a violation of the deepest commitments we hold about the preciousness of human life. Is that fair?
That's right. Yes, and in fact, you look at what Hitler did. He really said, I am the truth, and there is no truth higher than I. And
right.
He said to all the people who worked under him, well, look, your most fundamental obligation is the Führer. That's what your, you know, there's no conscience outside that, and you just follow.
Yeah.
And so, in fact, there really weren't very many strong international legal obligations which would say, you know, nobody can do this from an international standpoint. I mean, embedded in the international law at the time.
Right.
So therefore, we really just have to appeal to what the Universal Declaration called the common conscience of mankind, that there are some laws and norms which everybody knows or has the capacity to know as a rational person, as a person with that kind of transcendent dignity. And these things can be known, and people can be held accountable for violating them in egregious ways.
Why is it that there are critics out there who do not like natural law. I can remember when Clarence Thomas was being grilled during his hearings. Part of the criticism of Thomas is that he had published positively about natural law, and they were afraid that he would be a natural law jurist. And why does natural law have a bad reputation?
Sure. So when Secretary Pompeo first announced the commission in the Federal Register on May 30th, he talked about the disjuncture between human rights and natural law and natural rights. And as you say, this led to a kind of great fury in the media, people reacting to natural law and natural rights. And what they said is that natural law and natural rights are kind of a fig leaf for conservative politics, religious commitments, but most of all, the denial of abortion and LGBTQ rights. And you know, on that score, I would say, well, they were essentially right. That I would say, though, that natural law reveals the problems with the abortion rights and LGBTQ rights. In a sense, they're right to be concerned. But for that reason, I would say this is one of the major problems of the human rights community, that it is really taken up the promotion of rights that don't have a basis in natural law and run strongly contrary to it.
That was one of the criticisms of the UN's declaration, right? That they agreed on what rights were, but didn't agree on what rights or why these rights were there.
Well, yes. Now, you know, Jacques Maritain, the great Catholic philosopher, once said, "Yeah, we agree upon what they are, but not on why."
Right.
And he thought that was okay. And you know, and to have an international document and to try to get international consensus of many different cultures, you know, doesn't necessarily have to have a. We don't necessarily have to ask people to agree to a philosophy. You know, the U.S. Constitution doesn't have a philosophy and say you have to agree to this. However. You know, if one wants to then ask the deeper question, though, you know, what is a good basis for human rights? What can ground them? What do we need to believe in order to say there are human rights, particularly when they start coming under great pressure? Well, I think that's where it's hard to get around the natural law question.
Yeah, I think that it becomes, I mean, we see this all the time. Muslim-dominated nations, China, believe that the West's concern with human rights is simply our own, that's an outgrowth of our own ethnocentrism.
They don't
buy the argument. And so it seems to me this is something, if we're going to be moving, asking for a world of peace, if we're trying to move in such a way that we can learn to live with our deepest differences, we've got to have a way of saying that some things are right and other things are wrong and that it has universal application. Otherwise, we're just offering a council of despair. Ultimately, we can't live without some common understanding of a, I don't know what you call it, a universal absolute, moral absolute or something.
Yeah, I think that's precisely right. And if you look at dictatorships who are widely committing torture or other kinds of vast compromises of human dignity, well, it's interesting that, you know, vice pays tribute to virtue. They usually have to find some kind of way of sort of hiding from the white glare of truth. In other words, they need to find some kind of justification. Either they keep it hiding and try not to let people know about it, or they come up with, they offer a justification. You know, the security situation here is so exigent that, you know, you naive people from the West don't understand what we're facing, or, you know, the importance of modernity or economic modernization or something, you know, just overrides this kind of thing about human rights that you keep bringing up. And so, you know, these can be strong justifications, and many will believe them and kind of buy onto them. Well, if you don't have a foundation in truth, something that can say, no, no matter what your cause, you just can't break an egg, no matter how good your omelet, well, then I don't think it's going to be very hard to make the case for human rights.
Right. I agree. Dan, thanks so much. We'll talk again on this. I hope
hope
this works out very well. We've called Marianne Glendon to get her take on it, so I'm hoping to talk with her, too, about it. Thanks, Dan.
Wonderful. Thanks, Al, for your great work.
Okay. Dan Philpott, again, ARC of the universe, .info is where you want to go to follow his great work.
The EWTN home video highlight for July is The Chaplet of the Divine Mercy. This beautiful new rendition of the beloved devotional was shot on location at the National Shrine of the Divine Mercy in Stockbridge, Massachusetts. Enjoy five versions of this invocation of trust in our Lord. Order your DVD at EWTNRC.com 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, or call 1-800-854-6316.
We have a problem. Our culture is dying, and souls are in danger of being lost. The answer is conversion to Jesus Christ in His church. St. Paul Street Evangelization is a Catholic organization, and we have hundreds of teams spreading the good news throughout the country. But we need your help. The harvest is great, but the laborers are few. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com, a nonprofit company.
Cresta in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization, Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 80% of the referral check to Ave Maria Radio and Students for Life. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
We know how much you love Ave Maria Radio, so please consider joining us in our Care to Share program. It's easy. We send you 10 business size cards that give you all the great ways that someone can listen to Ave Maria Radio, and you just give them away. Share them with those you love and those who would really benefit from our great programming. For more information, go to AveMariaRadio.net and click on the Community tab to find the Care to Share program link. That's AveMariaRadio.net, Community, and Care to Share.
Welcome to Spirit of Stewardship. Jeremy Belsky is your host for real-life stories, encouragement, and ideas to enhance your own gifts of work, wealth, and wisdom in response to God's blessings for you.
I'm Jeremy Belsky, and today's topic is Stewardship of the Environment, God's Creation of Nature. When you hear the message, be a wise steward of your resources, do you ever consider the role you play in your community environment? It's natural to think of time, talent, and treasure when stewardship is mentioned, but our faith teaches us that all is gift from God. Thus, respect for nature and doing our part to ensure a safe and clean environment is important. Here are just three areas we can pay more attention. A lot of action has been taken in recent years by nonprofits geared towards a cleaner environment. The first area of focus is to eliminate litter. Consider how your actions to pick up after yourself are pleasing to God. Be proud to do your part to keep your community and neighborhood clean. Secondly, look at ways to recycle and make the most out of your purchases. Does it matter to you that so much plastic consumes our landfills? Have you given thought as to how you can make a particular purchase last longer? Third, in a country filled with abundance, what's being done to ensure our nature and environment for the next generation? This is more than eating bread crust and cleaning off your plate. The root lies in not wasting what we've been given. There's a great deal of time and effort that goes into caring for our place of residence in addition to our possessions. Keeping up what is ours or giving our used possessions to the less fortunate are a couple of ways to be prudent stewards of our blessings from God. I'm Jeremy Belsky, your host for Spirit of Stewardship.
To learn how you can better share your talents and resources, contact your local parish priest. Your level of involvement in the church now positively impacts our faith in the future.
Good afternoon to you. I'm Al Cresta. The success of the U.S. Women's World Cup team has generated conversation not only about their performance, but about the gender wage gap. Players on the women's team earn a base salary of, it's $3,600 per game. The men earn a base salary of $5,000 a game. Statistics show that women earn, and other people claim that women earn about 80 cents on the dollar throughout the economy. Is that true? I mean, in the case, the first question I would have about the soccer team is I'd just like to know, I don't even know what wages depend upon. Normally, when you're in the entertainment industry, you get compensated based on how many people you can get to buy tickets. Do people go and watch men's soccer more than they go and watch women's soccer? But a lot of these questions come up, and turning it into a gender issue right off the top keeps us from thinking critically, I believe, about the problem. With me right now to help us think critically about these issues is Dr. Angela Dills. She's a distinguished professor of regional economic development at Western Carolina University. She's a labor economist whose research focuses on economics of education, crime, and health. And Angela, nice to have you with me. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Well, people are talking about the gender wage gap recently because of the women's soccer discussion. Have you paid attention to that debate?
I have both been on vacation and locked up at a conference for about a week and a half. So.
Okay.
Not as much as I should have, although well, I watched the finals. So.
Well, it's part of an ongoing, as you know, it's part of an ongoing claim that women earn, I don't know, 75, 80 cents on the dollar for men. And that's thrown around kind of almost as a cliche now. But what is it? What is the truth when it comes to the gender wage gap? Do we have a major issue of injustice here? Or is this something to be explained by the unique circumstances of various industries?
Great. So the number you quote is the typical number. So people say women make 80 cents for every dollar a man makes. What typically is made less clear when that statistic is thrown around is what they're comparing at that point is they're taking the median woman, so the woman who makes more than half of all the other full-time, full-year working women and less than half of all the full-time, full-year women, the median woman, and she makes 80 cents for that median man, when we take the guy who's right in the middle from among all the men. So it's presented as this apples to apples. So if it's presented as though women and men in the same job, the woman is earning 80 cents on the dollar. But that's not actually the case. Women on average earn 80 cents on every dollar. Once we control for some of their choices, whether that's schooling or hours worked, the industries they work in, factors like that, you know, the gender gap is more like 5 cents on the dollar. You know, women are earning 95 cents for every dollar a man earns. Or in some industries, it's much less. In some industries, it's a little bit more.
And so, so obviously then the claim, it seems obvious to me anyways, that the claim that women earn 80 cents on the dollar is really serves other it doesn't serve the issue of truth as much as the issue of politics, I guess.
I agree. I think it hides the true issues, some true concerns. We may be really interested in why in particular industries there are actual gender gaps, and we want to dig into those a little more deeply.
Sure.
But when we float around a number that's not really reflecting what we care about, I think it's misleading, and intentionally so in many cases.
Yeah. I mean, I think most, in some sense, I don't know anybody. I mean, I'm trying to think if I've ever known anybody who thinks that somehow women don't deserve to earn as much as men if it's comparable work, right? I mean, that's kind of just basic. People believe that equal pay for equal work. That's well established in the popular mind.
Yes, I think most humans have a very innate sense of fairness, and that's
right.
Part of it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about some of the issues that are play into these discussions. There's industry-specific concerns, and I suppose that has to do with hours one spends working. It has to do with how sustained your employment is. If you take if women take years off to raise children, for instance, they may not accumulate as much seniority as a man would if he didn't leave. So what are some of the issues that make keep this issue alive besides its political usefulness?
Well, I think you hit on a couple of them. So some of the reasons that explain kind of lingering raw gender wage gaps, one is women are much more likely to be spending time out of the labor force, whether that's taking a maternity leave and taking a big gap, or whether it's working full-time but working shorter hours than a full-time man might work. And that limits the amount of experience you're accumulating, and so women on average are accumulating less experience, which is important because when you work more hours, when you accumulate experience, you become more productive, you're more valuable to your firm, they're willing to pay you more money.
Sure.
So that certainly matters. Another part that is becoming more important in our economy is there's a bigger return to working long hours in some industries. So in some industries, the consumer really cares, the customer really cares that they get their particular person. So the example that's prominent in the literature is lawyers. So if you're involved in a lawsuit and something important happens on the weekend, you want to be able to call your lawyer, not some general lawyer in the law firm, but you want the person who's aware of the facts of your case. And so there's a large return to working long hours as a lawyer. So working 80 hours a week, you will earn more than twice what you would have if you had worked only 40 hours a week.
And women are less likely to work 80 hours a week?
Yes, exactly. Women are less likely to, significantly less likely to want to work 80 hours a week, to want to work long hours in general. And so they're missing out on some of those long returns in favor of their choices that they're making to do other things.
So would the gender gap in pay then be reduced considerably if various industries or firms did not have an incentive to disproportionately reward individuals who labor long hours or particular hours?
I think it would go a long way to it. And we've seen it happen in some industries. Obstetrics is probably the big one.
Which one? What is that?
Your physician delivering your baby.
Right? Oh, okay.
I mean, it used to be the case that you expected your doctor to deliver your baby.
Yeah.
Most of the time these days, your physician works for a practice, and you're going to get whoever's on call that evening.
Right.
It's not necessarily going to be the one you've been seeing throughout your pregnancy, which is actually good for the obstetricians because that means they can work a reasonable work week. They can work a 40 or 50, 50-hour work week and still be compensated like their peers are. But some of that's changing the expectations of the clients. Or in this case, the patients.
My wife and I have seen that in our experience too. That in a number of, we have five children, and in a few of those cases, the doctor she had been visiting, the obstetrician she'd been visiting, wasn't available to deliver the baby, and so somebody in the practice, somebody else in the practice did. We didn't find that to be, especially distressing. Just accepted it as a matter of that's the way the world works right now. So you got the question of hours, compensation for long hours that are more likely to be filled by men than women. What are some of the other areas?
So we can think of kind of the reasons different people get paid different amounts of money fall in two categories. Either there's something different about the workers or there's something different about the jobs. So for workers, that might be working longer hours and accumulating more experience. It might be obtaining more schooling. It might also be, and one of the things that's particularly relevant for the gender wage gap is the kind of skills that you accumulate. So men who attend college tend to major in very different disciplines than women who attend college. And men tend to major in more quantitative disciplines.
Okay.
They graduate college with a different kind of skill. Even though they both have college degrees, the men tend to be in more quantitative disciplines, and the women tend to be in less quantitative disciplines.
Okay.
And more quantitative disciplines pay more.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's some sorting like that based on the kinds of skills that workers have. Men also tend to take more dangerous jobs, and there's a compensation that comes with that. If you want people to work in a job that's a little bit more dangerous, then you're going to have to pay them more, or they're not going to be willing to take on that risk. And men on average are more willing to take on that risk. But that risk comes with a reward. It comes with higher pay. So, you know, some of those things are plausibly choices, right? To the extent that men and women are making those different choices because men like math more, or they like the quantitative disciplines more. Women are choosing the humanities and education because they love those fields. That's great. I mean, I think we all flourish when we're making choices that are, you know, great for our skills and interests.
Right.
You know, the challenge, and I think the part where maybe other social sciences have a lot to say is, you know, what if they're not making those choices? If those choices are being made for them.
Right.
Which clearly was the case in the, you know, 1960s, early 70s, right? I mean, the women's choices were much more limited than they are today. I think we're a little more, and there are high-profile examples of bad climates for women in some disciplines. But it's hard to untangle, particularly as an economist, perhaps, how much of that is personal preferences, which is great, and how much of that is social pressure,
which is less
ideal. Yeah.
Are you aware of any particular industry or any area of the U.S. economy in which there is a clear injustice committed against women, where all things being equal, they actually do earn less and deserve more?
I'm not aware of current examples, but certainly we hear of them. There are lawsuits. There are particular cases that women bring where they've been clearly wronged. And we know from other studies, from audit studies, that, you know, there is discrimination that happens when we send out, you know, faked up resumes, for example, for jobs, some with men's names and some with women's names, with their differential callback rates. So, you know, so there is evidence that discrimination happens. But to the extent that that's playing a big role in the wage gap that's typically talked about in the media, it's much smaller than the media makes it out to be, on average, excluding yourself, obviously. You're well-versed here.
Well, Angela, thank you so much. I do appreciate you joining me today. We'll talk again. Thanks.
Thank you.
Dr. Angela Dills, Distinguished Professor of Regional Economic Development at Western Carolina University. She works on the economics of education, crime, health, and she'll be with us again. I'm Al Cresta.
Bishop Robert Barron on the priesthood.
I've been a priest for 31 years. It's a call to a total gift to Christ. It's a total gift of one's life to be conformed to Christ. You know, and that's why I felt it when I was a young guy and I was kind of getting into religion and understanding it more deeply intellectually. It just began to hit me with a great clarity that if this is true, if God is real and God is a supreme good, well, why wouldn't I give my whole self to God? Why would I get distracted by anything else, you know? Now, again, I'm not saying that should be true for every single person on the planet. That's the way it hit me when I was a young guy, was I want to give as much as I can, my whole self, to Christ. So there's something heroic about that, where you do eschew a lot of things. You say no to a lot of things so you can say massively yes to Christ and to his demand. I think that's a heroic quality of it.
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
What composes a society? The Catholic Catechism says human beings need to live in society. It is there that we develop our potential. The Catechism defines a society as a group of persons bound together by a principle of unity that goes beyond each one of them. A society endures through time. We owe loyalty to the communities that we are part of which are defined by their purpose. All social institutions, however, ought to have the human person as its principle, subject, and end. The societies of family and of state are necessary to the nature of man. Other societies, such as voluntary associations and institutions, are encouraged for economic, cultural, athletic, and professional reasons. The Church warns against certain types of socialization wherein excessive intervention of the state threatens personal freedom and initiative. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
Well, good being with you this last hour. Thank you. I'm Al Cresta, and we've got more coming up, another hour ahead of us, where we're going to be talking about, get an update on the economy. My guest, George Schwartz from the Ave Maria Mutual Funds, one of our sponsors here on Cresta in the Afternoon. Stocks did have an overall strong first half of the year, but people are worrying about the markets. I mean, there's all this fear of trade wars, trafficking, this uncertainty. We're going to talk with George about that as he's been watching the markets. And then we're going to take time with Dr. Eduardo Echevarria from Sacred Heart Major Seminary. You may have heard that there is a working document that the bishops of the Amazon region have been working on. They have a meeting in Rome next October. And this document has some real shortcomings to it. We're going to talk to Ed about the problems with it. And I do think this comes to the question of what's commonly called religious pluralism, or did God positively will a diversity of competing religions on the earth? Historic Catholicism says absolutely not. And I think it's well established that the teaching of the Catholic Church is that Christ instituted the Catholic Church in a way that no other religion has been instituted. We'll talk it over, though, with Eduardo Echevarria next hour. I'm Al Cresta. You can follow up on any of our conversations at AveMariaRadio.net.
This hour of Cresta in the Afternoon is co-produced by Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Cresta in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
With the New York Times in one hand and the Catechism of the Catholic Church in the other, Al Cresta is ready for conversations of consequence.
America is as divided as it has been in 150 years.
Politics is symptomatic of the culture.
They don't have a personal relationship with Christ.
We've been sacramentalized, but not evangelized.
Why should Washington listen to us when our own house is in disarray?
The Church's greatest riches are her people.
Share the contagious joy of being a friend of Christ.
Story after story after story. Story of people who have had inexplicable healings.
Broadcasting from the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and taking a closer Catholic look at current events, issues, and ideas. This is Cresta in the Afternoon.
That's beautifully said, Al.
Thanks for your voice for liberty.
It's like a homecoming each time on your program.
Clear to me that you've thought these things through at a deep level.
Let's build the church, and then we'll bless the nations. And good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. Thanking you for joining me. Coming up next hour, we'll be talking with George Schwartz. We'll be talking about the economy and some of the problems that we've been facing in the U.S. economy. The truth is, the U.S. economy is actually quite strong right now, and even the markets have been doing fine. But there's still a lot of fear out there because of threatening of tariffs and trade wars and all of that. George Schwartz is going to give us a update. One of our sponsors here on Cresta in the Afternoon, the Ave Maria Mutual Funds. The heart of the hour, though, is going to be taken up with Dr. Eduardo Echevarria of Sacred Heart Major Seminary. There's a much-debated working document for the Synod of Bishops for the Pan-Amazon region. And Cardinal Gerhard Müller, who served for a while as the prefect of the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, he's pointed out that this is a bad piece of work. And Ed's been doing a great deal of research into it and writing on it. There's a lot of confusion about what we call, quote, religious pluralism. There are actually Catholics, theologians, even some bishops and priests who will not defend the idea that the Catholic Church is the one true church. And I don't say that triumphalistically. I say this simply as a matter of fact. And when it comes to dealing with world religions, Christ is the incarnate Word of God. If a religious system denies that Christ is the incarnate Word of God, then we have a conflict. And no amount of goodwill will overcome that conflict. It's simply a matter of truth or falsity. We're going to talk that over with, Ed Echevarria from Sacred Heart Major Seminary. But first, let's get to the headlines.
Thanks, Al. Good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Monday, July 15th. It's the Feast of St. Bonaventure. Today's news is brought to you by the Ave Maria Family of Funds at AveMariaFunds.com. President Trump is responding to critics about his bashing of four freshman congresswomen. Backlash began after Trump said the women, who are all American citizens and women of color, should all go back to their own countries and fix problems there. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer hit Republicans for remaining largely silent.
He's not backing off. Where are you when something this serious, this bigoted, this un-American happens?
Today, Trump said at the White House that all four complain a lot, and if they're unhappy, they should leave the United States. Trump also called them socialists and said they hate America. President Trump also insisting that the weekend ICE raids were very successful.
Many, many were taken out on Sunday. You just didn't know about it.
Talking with reporters at the White House, Trump also said the operation is ongoing. Meanwhile, the Trump administration also proposing a new restriction on migrants seeking asylum in the U.S. According to the DOJ and DHS officials, the restriction would deny anyone who crosses the southern border for seeking asylum in the U.S. if they came to another country and didn't seek asylum there. A new poll shows the majority of Americans are opposed to making the District of Columbia the 51st state. The Gallup poll released today found 64% of Americans don't think the nation's capital should attain statehood. Only 29% supported the idea. The poll comes as D.C. Congresswoman Eleanor Holmes Norton has gained a record number of supporters in Congress for statehood. The House Oversight Committee was scheduled to hold a hearing on the issue July 24th, but it was postponed because it was scheduled on the same day. Special Counsel Robert Mueller will testify before House committees. I'm Steve Clark, Ave Maria Radio News.
Good afternoon to you. I'm Al Cresta. Stocks had a seemingly strong start this year and a minor correction in May. Investors have reason to be satisfied with the market's 2019 performance, but still people are concerned that the stock market is lagging expectations. Of course, they're comparing it to great performances earlier in the Trump administration. What can we expect for the second half of this year? My guest is George Schwartz, founder, chairman, and CEO of Schwartz Investment Counsel and chairman and CEO of the Ave Maria Mutual Funds. His newest book is In God We Trust, Morally Responsible Investing. And you can follow the work that George is engaged in at AveMariaFunds.com and SchwartzInvest.com. George, good to have you back here. Thanks.
Great to be with you, as always, Al.
Well, you've made it very clear over the years that predicting the future of the market is, in some ways, a futile effort. But at the same time, we can't avoid analyzing and projecting, at least in our own minds here. People are comparing, talking about the market lagging, but what's that in comparison to?
Well, it's a strange thing, Al. You know, for all the good things that are going on, investors can't seem to enjoy themselves. Never have I seen so much pessimism with the stock market making new highs.
Yeah.
And with the real U.S. economic growth doing so well. It's been an unloved bull market. As evidence, just this past week, investors pulled $25 billion out of domestic stock funds. And the money's going into money market funds, showing that there's a lot of pessimism,
they're scared.
Worried.
They're scared, huh?
They're scared, yeah.
Yeah. Is it the threat of the trade war with China?
Well, I call it the four T's: trade, tariffs, Trump, and tweets. So politics centers into everything, of course.
Yeah.
But there is a lot of uncertainty, but there's always a lot of uncertainty. And I get a kick out of talking heads on television that say, well, we'll just see what happens when all this uncertainty clears up. There's always uncertainty, and it never all clears up.
That's right.
But it's been an unloved bull market, and there's an old expression on Wall Street that bull markets climb a wall of worry, and there are a lot of things to worry about, but there always is.
Yeah, yeah.
But the as you pointed out, the first half of 2019 was a strong period for stocks, particularly stocks, up around 18%. And
that's big, right? I mean, that's a
that's huge. That would be ordinarily 2 full years worth of price appreciation,
yeah,
or total return on stocks, which have averaged 9 or 10% per year. But here we're up 18% in the first half of this year, and it's been caused in part by the good things coming out of Washington, out of the Trump administration, particularly tax cuts and deregulation,
mm-hmm,
which has been on par with Larry Kudlow's advice to,
yeah,
the president. Our friend Larry Kudlow, of course, is very influential with the current administration.
Sure.
And President Trump has taken his advice, and it's been positive for American investors and American consumers and job creation, and all within the context of low inflation and low inflation expectations. But with the economy in the first half of the year was up about 2.3% or 2.4%, which followed 3% growth last year. So there's been a slight deceleration in the rate of growth. For the full year, we're expecting 2.5% plus for the full year.
For the
on
full
average.
Year?
Okay. For the full year. So, again, that'll be up from, or that'll compare with 3.1% in the first quarter. First quarter was up 3.1%, very strong. But what will the stocks do in the second half? Well, as you made reference to, trying to predict short-term move in stock prices,
right,
is a fool's errand.
Sure.
It's anyone's guess, short-term. Stock prices are unpredictable, and anyone that says that they know what stocks are going to do in the near term is either very naive or they think you're naive.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's, short-term moves are related to things that are truly unpredictable. Long-term is a different story. Long-term, stocks will go up in all likelihood, as they,
uh-huh,
have for many, many years. And there's always bumps along the way, but there was a turning point with this administration following the Obama years of almost stagnant,
right,
economic activity, 1.5% real growth. I always say the Obama regulations and taxes were the foot of government on the neck of capitalism.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think the Obama administration was trying to solve social problems by what they perceived as social problems by penalizing corporations.
Yeah, through the economy.
It's a different ballgame today. So Trump's programs have been pro-growth and pro-capitalism. And for our Ave Maria Mutual Fund shareholders, they're happy to see that the Trump administration has been pro-life.
Yeah, yeah, that's been a very, very big plus. He's been very explicitly pro-life. And he's also been great when it comes to appointing judges in the federal bench.
Huge, yeah.
I'm curious, though, about this, your four T's. I think that's very helpful. trade, tariffs, Trump, and tweets. The president is a man who many people were attracted to him and are attracted to him because he was successful in the world of business. So he understands,
right,
how businessmen think. So he knows how skittish people are, and yet he doesn't seem – his tweets always seem to keep things a little it makes people nervous.
No kidding.
So that's got to contribute to part of this, right? That people think that, well, we just don't know. I mean, there's this worry, right, that something, Something might happen. There's going to be a big trade war with China. Or somehow the semiconductor industry is going to collapse. There's constant worry. And he doesn't seem to mind that, but lots of people do. Why do you think he continues to keep that sense of uncertainty in front of us?
Well, he's a different kind of politician, or maybe you could say he's not a politician at all in some respects. And for all his shortcomings, and he certainly has some, he's got a lot of shortcomings, his policies, his economic policies have been and are likely to continue to be very positive for the country. I think he's got a unique ability to read the public, and certainly his base is for him. And,
sure.
Whether that's 40% or 45%, depending on what poll you look at, it's solid, and I think it's going to result in a re-election, but it's anybody's guess, and I'm certainly no expert on forecasting political developments or election results, but it's a positive scenario that's going on right now for our country, for capitalism, for democracy. And the overall economy looks to be in pretty good shape.
And
you know, employment, unemployment is extremely low at 3.5% or 3.6%, 3.7%, even with more and more participants entering the job market.
Yeah, I mean, it used to be said that we had to tolerate 5% unemployment. That used to be the percentage that was thrown out there. 5% unemployment is actually, quote, full employment, is what they used to say.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And the fact that inflation remains so low, and it's, you know, running near 2%, a little under 2%, which is the Federal Reserve's target, long-term target. It's been running below 2% for quite some time. But even in spite of that, the Federal Reserve is probably going to reduce interest rates still this month.
So,
and then later in the year, probably cut some more. And it'll have the effect, assuming that happens, which I think is almost baked into the cake now, it'll have the effect of bringing the so-called yield curve back into positive formation. Right now it's negatively sloped or inverted. And
so long-term interest rates depend on inflation expectations?
Typically, yes.
Okay.
And short-term interest rates usually are determinants of short-term economic activity.
Okay.
So long-term rates, as measured by the 10-year Treasury, are running just a little over 2%. And the short-term rates, as measured by the federal funds rate, have been running around 2.5%.
Gotcha.
So that results in a negative yield curve.
Mm-hmm.
And historically, a negative yield curve, if it lasts for several months, will bring about a recession.
Okay.
But in our view, a recession is at least a few years out, and it'll be further forestalled by short-term rate reductions, which the Fed is widely expected to make again later this month and later in the year.
Okay. So are these interest rates relatively low, historically speaking?
Yeah, they are. They're extremely low, historically speaking, in this country and around the world. And it's a startling development has taken place overseas, where they're are currently over $13 trillion of government bonds trading at negative interest rates.
Wow.
It's hard to believe anyone would lend money expecting to get less than their principal back.
I don't get that. You're going to have to explain that to me.
It's supply and demand, and the central banks around the world are trying to goose their economy. And in Europe especially, but it's not working. The old adage that lower interest rates will stimulate the economy hasn't been accurate, or hasn't been fruitful in the European economies. But those negative interest rates around the world help keep our interest rates low, particularly in our bond market, which I said is yielding around 2% on the 10-year Treasury. It's a little over 2% today.
George, I'll have to have you back to talk a little bit about this. This is something I was completely unaware of, this issue of negative interest rates around the globe on bonds. Tell us, sure. I'll have you back to talk about that in the future. How can people get a hold of you?
People can reach us at toll-free number 866 Ave Maria, or go online to AveMariaFunds.com.
AveMariaFunds.com. George, thanks so much. Great talking with you.
Nice talking with you, Al.
It's time for Family Man with Dr. Gregory Popchuk.
Want to be more successful? Be humble. A study at Duke University found that successful people tend to exhibit more humility than less successful people in the same field. Being humble doesn't mean beating up on yourself or denying real gifts or talents. That's self-deprecation, which is neither a strength nor a virtue. Exercising true humility, in both the theological and psychological sense, means being willing to see that you don't have all the answers and you can learn a lot from listening to the people around you. Researchers found that humble people did a better job of adapting to new circumstances and soliciting support from others, both of which contributed to the increased success of more humble participants in the study. Jesus said that the meek will inherit the earth. Well, science and the Bible agree. Let humility be the secret of your success. I'm Dr. Greg Popchuk, but you can call me Family Man.
To discover more ways faith can enrich your life, visit CatholicCounselors.com.
Ever wonder why social networking is such a popular internet exercise? We humans are hardwired for society. It's in our DNA. The human person needs to live in society, the Catholic Catechism tells us. It is a requirement of man's nature. There is a certain resemblance between the unity of the three divine persons and the fraternity that humans are to establish among themselves in truth and love. As Jesus made clear, love of God is inseparable from love of neighbor. Humanity's vocation, says the Catechism, is to show forth the image of God and be transformed into the image of the Father's only Son, Jesus. It is through mutual service and dialogue with one another that we develop our potential and thus respond to the end to which we are called, God Himself. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
I worked in pro baseball for a long time, and we play on Sundays. And it was an easy excuse. I took the easy out and just didn't go to Mass. Got caught up in that whole selfishness, that whole, I can do it all. The times when I was struggling were the times I needed God the most. And now that I've come back and accepted God, my world has completely changed.
If you've been away from the Catholic Church for any reason, visit CatholicsComeHome.org today.
Solidarity HealthShare began out of the Christian tradition of neighbor helping neighbor. They're a nonprofit medical cost-sharing ministry in which their members share in each other's eligible medical expenses. Solidarity HealthShare is not insurance, but rather an alternative way to pay for medical costs that adheres to the teachings of the Catholic Church. They'll never share in a medical care that goes against their values and morals, such as abortion, contraception, and sterilization. More information available at SolidarityHealthShare.org or at 844-313-4999.
When the need for senior care arises, home is where the heart is. Visiting Angels provides home care for mom or dad up to 24 hours per day, including personal care, meals, and light housework. You may select your professional caregiver with Visiting Angels. More information at visitingangels.com or at 877-374-LIVE. That's 877-374-LIVE. Visiting Angels, America's choice in senior home care.
Hi, everybody. Dr. A here. Well, being a grandparent's just like being a parent, isn't it? Only different here. I have a book with that same title. And in that book, I take on the ups and the downs of being grandparents. It's a second go around with the kids in a way that mirrors God's own unconditional love for us. You can get the book and my many others at AveMariaRadio.net.
Good afternoon, I'm Al Cresta. You may have heard of a working document for the Synod of Bishops. It's for their Pan-Amazon region, And this working document, I guess they call it the Instrumentum Laboris, really looks like it's a big problem. With me right now to talk about it is Dr. Eduardo Echevarria. Has been with us a number of times before, talking about the Pope Francis pontificate, but also wide questions regarding ecumenism and the Catholic faith. And so he's published on this already, so you've had a chance to read it, is that right?
Yes, yes, it came out June 25th.
Okay, and there is an English version of it.
The Catholic thing.
Yeah.
The document itself, it came out.
Yes.
I'm not sure exactly when.
Yes, okay.
But the article that I published was on the Catholic thing.
Right, right.
June 25th.
And so you looked at the working document there.
Right, right.
A working document is what? It's just, it's something that...
It's a draft.
It's a draft.
It's what in the churches, you know, like the Vatican II documents, when they were drafts, they were called schemas. So these are this is a draft document. It's supposed to provide some sense of orientation as to the major issues that will be discussed at the synod in October.
In October.
It's not a final document.
Right. So there's going to be a synod of bishops from the Amazon region.
Right, right.
And that's going to be in October.
Right.
And this is the working document for them to deal with. It's entitled Amazonia, New Paths for the Church and for an Integral Ecology. And you write that it implicitly accepts the presupposition that God willed the diversity of religions, that he willed religious pluralism. And by that, you mean that they believe that all religions have some contribution to make to salvation history, or that no religions are superior to others? I mean, is this a denial that the Catholic Church is a teaching church, that we've been instituted by Christ to teach what he taught, and that he has given us his Spirit to ensure that we teach truly? Do they deny that the Catholic Church has a doctrine which is different from the indigenous peoples of the Amazon?
Right. So a number of things. One is religious pluralism is the view that God has somehow been legitimately revealed in a variety of ways in the diversity of religions, that there's a sense in which all religions are equally vehicles of salvation, that in some sense they're all equally true. I think this view is indistinguishable from religious relativism.
Yeah, because Islam and Christianity can't both be true.
No, that's right. So you can't make truth claims on this. If you operate with this view, if you're a religious relativist, and I think that this document implicitly presumes religious relativism, then you can't make truth claims. You can't say, you can't make absolute truth claims. You can't say that if Christianity is true, then its denial must be false.
Right.
You can't say if you have a religion that denies, like Islam, that denies that Jesus died on the cross, you can't say that that's false. Now, I always say the church doesn't say that other religions are false in everything that they claim.
Right, right.
They're only false with respect to those things that are incompatible with Christian truth claims.
Sure.
Okay, so you can find elements of truth and goodness there, but the fact is that the way that those elements are received may be distorted, may ultimately even reject the very thing that they're trying to receive. So, for instance, you find in the document an emphasis on creation, a doctrine of creation, but then creation seems to be distorted, misinterpreted, and actually rejected, because even though they try to have proper regard for the order of God's creation, in this document it seems indistinguishable from pantheism, what they call an Amazon cosmovision. Pantheism is the idea that God is in everything. You know, that pan is the Greek word for everything. Huh?
Yeah.
And so God is everything. So I think that their implicit acceptance of religious relativism predisposes them to accept an understanding of enculturation. Of course, we want the Christian faith to be enculturated. You remember John Paul II once wrote that if the Christian faith is not embodied culturally,
right,
that means it's not well thought out. It hasn't been lived and so on.
That's right.
But their understanding of enculturation, this document's understanding of enculturation, is really accommodation. It's primarily the call to adapt or to accommodate the totality of the Catholic faith ecclesiastically, liturgically, and even doctrinally to the Amazonian cultures. So that means, in their understanding of enculturation, there's this lopsided fascination with receiving whatever is perceived to be good and true in those cultures, and so the Catholic faith loses its transcendent standpoint, its critical and hence normative distance over the culture. It makes the culture. That's where this document is aside from the religious pluralism, fundamentally flawed, because it makes the culture rather than Catholicism authoritative sources of the faith, scripture and tradition, the standard of the gospel.
So basically, the Catholic missionary goes to the people of the Amazon and says, teach me something.
Mm-hmm.
I really don't have anything to offer you.
Right.
You teach me.
Right, right, right. And so the primary stance is a dialogical one, which in fact, fosters a general religious indifferentism.
Yeah.
There's no sense of evangelizing. There's no sense of, you know, recognizing that there are these incompatible truth claims.
This is not just saying if you want to be effective in your mission, you need to listen.
No.
Because
of course that's true. I always tell the students if you want to engage, Islamic theologians in conversation, you need to read the Quran,
right?
You have to listen. But then there has to come, after you listen, this is with respect to everything, you have to let them formulate the issues as they understand them. But then after you've listened, you have to engage in critical discussion and evaluate their arguments, assess the arguments, and so on and so on. None of that is present in this document.
I mean, St. Paul in Acts chapter 17.
Right.
He's greatly distressed when he's walking through the marketplace.
Right.
He sees all these idols.
Right.
He's greatly distressed, all the idols he sees.
Right.
And then he notices that there's one altar to an unknown God.
Right.
So when he gets his opportunity to speak, he doesn't slam them for saying, what idolaters you are, you violated the first commandment.
Right, right.
What he says, wow, I can see you're all very religious here.
Right.
And you have this altar to an unknown God. So what you worship is unknown. Let me proclaim to you.
Right, right, right. He doesn't say, oh, I see you're very religious, so what am I doing here? I don't really need to be here, do I?
Right.
You guys are all right.
Right, right.
No, but this document, and it's so unnerving. This document, I say in my article, actually warns against the absolutizing of any creed.
Whoa.
In other words, that means it warns against saying it's absolutely true that the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. And so if that statement is true, that means that there can't be a state of affairs in which that's denied, and in which it's okay to deny it, and in which somehow that statement wouldn't be false. Wow. So you can't absolutize any creed. You can't make absolute statements. To make an absolute statement means that this statement is true, and hence its denial must be false, and anyone who holds its denial must be wrong. They leave us with the idea that there are differences. Remember, we live in a culture where there are no true propositions about religion. Yeah. If there are no true propositions, there are no false ones either.
That's right.
There are just differences, and nobody's wrong. So if you're told, now, don't make absolute truth claims. Don't think that it's absolutely true that the Word was made flesh and dwelt among us, that Jesus died for us on the cross, that he rose from the dead, that he ascended to the Father and intercedes for us at the right hand of the Father. The authors of this document claim that if you absolutize the Christian creed, that results in the failure to recognize other ways in which God makes himself known. And remember, they're not distinguishing here between God's general revelation,
right,
where God reveals himself in and through the works of creation. You and I are evidence of God's, remember Romans 1, 18 and following?
Yeah, yeah.
That's one thing. But they're not making those distinctions.
For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes and
exactly
powers have been clearly seen through what he's been
or
made.
Or in the Acts of the Apostles, where it tells that God has not left himself without witness.
Right.
They're not talking about those things. Because even, of course, there may be elements of truth and goodness there, but it's not as if they've been received in a kind of a pure way, as if they haven't been distorted in their reception,
right,
or
right,
misinterpreted in their reception, yeah, or even at the end of the day, actually rejected. So, you know, consequently, they say that if you absolutize your creed, you close off to others who profess different creeds salvation.
No, how can that be?
No.
Jesus is the incarnate Word of God. If you say he is not the incarnate Word of God,
well, that must be false. If you're a Christian and you hold your Christian, if you hold the incarnation belief to be true, then its denial must be false.
It has to be false.
You can't affirm and deny the same proposition, huh? If P is true, then not P must be false, and hence anyone who holds not P must be wrong. We're talking about the truth status. We're not talking now about how do I come to know that the Word was made flesh and dwelt among us.
So these people have lost the idea that truth is a property of propositions.
Right.
Such that a proposition is true if what it asserts is. So
is, in fact, a case about objective reality. They totally lost that.
Okay.
They've totally lost that. So they don't see the connection between holding something to be true and reality, objective reality.
So there's
reality.
No correspondence.
There's no correspondence.
Ah, yeah.
It's all dialogical. The content of faith, this is part of the danger of these, of misconstruing, you know, this synodical process and dialogue. It almost seems, Ratzinger talked about this in a 1975 essay, 10 years after Vatican II, where he says that it's almost as if we think that the content of faith is going to be generated by dialogue.
Yeah, yeah.
As opposed to it being something that's already given, revealed.
That's
and,
right.
And which we embrace.
Come back in just a minute. With me is Dr. Eduardo Echevarria, a professor of philosophy and theology at Sacred Heart Major Seminary, the author of an updated and expanded version of Pope Francis, The Legacy of Vatican II. I'm Al Cresta.
The EWTN home video highlight for July is The Chaplet of the Divine Mercy. This beautiful new rendition of the beloved devotional was shot on location at the National Shrine of the Divine Mercy in Stockbridge, Massachusetts. Enjoy five versions of this invocation of trust in our Lord. Order your DVD at EWTNRC.com 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, or call 1-800-854-6316.
Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you're automatically own shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria mutual funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria mutual funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria mutual funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
This program is brought to you in part by Charity Mobile, a proud partner of Ave Maria Radio for over 10 years. Charity Mobile is the pro-life cell phone company, and has sent nearly $2 million to thousands of pro-life charities. 4G LTE coverage is available nationwide, and 5% of your monthly plan cost goes to your favorite pro-life charity. A video introduction is available at CharityMobile.com. Charity Mobile, everyday living, effortless giving. CharityMobile.com.
We know how much you love Ave Maria Radio, so please consider joining us in our Care to Share program. It's easy. We send you 10 business size cards that give you all the great ways that someone can listen to Ave Maria Radio, and you just give them away. Share them with those you love and those who would really benefit from our great programming. For more information, go to AveMariaRadio.net and click on the Community tab to find the Care to Share program link. That's AveMariaRadio.net, Community, and Care to Share.
We recently prevailed in a lawsuit filed in an Oklahoma federal court by Raja E. Fatia,
a Muslim and a board member of CARE Oklahoma, against Chad and Nicole Neal, the owners of an Oklahoma gun range. Fatia was represented by lawyers from CARE, the ACLU, and a large New York law firm, the usual suspects. The American Freedom Law Center represented the Neals. The controversy arose when in 2015, Fatia entered the Neals gun range armed with a loaded military-issue handgun strapped to his side, a military-style rifle slung over his shoulder, magazines loaded with approximately 140 rounds of 9mm ammunition, a concealed recording device in his pocket, and a dangerous agenda. To create a controversy with armed individuals at the gun range, hoping that he would not be allowed to fire his weapons so he could file this meritless lawsuit and run to the media with his prearranged Islamophobia narrative, knowing that the liberal media would willingly serve as an echo chamber for his spurious claim of discrimination. CARE's lawsuit was dismissed with prejudice. CARE's extremely reckless and dangerous attempt to set up a lawsuit to make a political point has failed. Apparently, CARE and the ACLU didn't want to put CARE's nefarious ties to terrorism on trial, so they caved in. And in the end, the good guys won yet again. I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel for the American Freedom Law Center, bringing you this Faith and Freedom Minute. You can learn more about the American Freedom Law Center and its fight for your faith and freedom by visiting our website and liking us on Facebook.
Pope Emeritus Benedict XVI experienced many triumphs and near superhuman struggles during his papacy. Now go behind the scenes in Benedict Up Close, the inside story of 8 dramatic years, the latest release from EWTN Publishing. You'll learn how Pope Benedict's youth shaped his papacy, the real reason he resigned, and more. Benedict Up Close, available now at EWTNRC.com or call 1-800-854-6316.
Good afternoon to you. I'm Al Cresta. With me, Dr. Eduardo Echevarria, Professor of Philosophy and Theology at Sacred Heart Major Seminary. There's an upcoming synod in October for the bishops of the Amazon region, and they've been putting together their working document for this synod. It's what they call the Instrumentum Laboris. It's really a draft of what they're going to be dealing with come October. The synod is called Amazonia, New Paths for the Church and for an Integral Ecology, or Integral Ecology. My guest, Dr. Echevarria, says the document is a disaster. Well, off the air, we were just talking about this. It's hard to believe it. Go ahead and make that same point.
You
cannot really bring the Nicene Creed.
The Nicene Creed is only valid for the context in which it was asserted, you see, because it says, it warns us, and here I quote, respectful listening to the other does not impose formulations of faith expressed with other cultural reference that do not respond to their lived reality.
Say that again.
Respectful listening of the other does not impose formulations of faith, so Nicene Creed, Creed of Chalcedon, Trent,
Vatican II,
etc., expressed with other cultural reference that do not respond to their lived reality. So the lived reality of these Amazonian cultures, the people who live in these Amazonian cultures, becomes the touchstone for what it is that you consider to be true, what it is that you accept. So what you, I mean,
so
you,
because the Nicene Creed comes from 4th century Roman environment.
Right.
We can't take that and bring it to this conversation with the indigenous peoples of the Amazon.
Because it's not true to their lived reality.
Yes, it's not because they wouldn't understand it. It's that it's not true to
their
lived
reality. And so, but then you
can they bring me a creed?
Well, you could even ask, can you bring the Bible?
Right.
Can you bring the Bible? Can you have them, what about the, can you have them read the Gospel of John, the letters of St. Paul? Etc. I mean, the Old Testament, the New Testament, it's not true to their, it's almost as if their lived reality becomes the standard for judging whether what is asserted is somehow true or what is asserted is somehow real or justified. And so then the synod states, which is, again, also very troublesome, it says, lived in any religion pleases God.
Well,
it's not saying that God loves all men. It's not that Jesus in this is love that God, God died for all men, or it's not quoting John 3:16, etc.
I'm not sure what they mean. I don't even love love is a good thing. Authentic right. love is a good thing wherever you find it. But I have a suspicion that's not what they're
no,
saying.
No, that's not what they're saying, because that statement is preceded by the warning against the absolutizing of any creed,
right.
which the authors of this document claim results in the failure to recognize other ways in which God makes himself known and consequently closes salvation off to others who profess different creeds. But they also say, and here I'm quoting them, it claims that one discovers his, quote, identity from the encounter with the other, from the differences and coincidences that show us the inscrutability of the reality and mystery of the presence of God. So this is saying that I'm going to really discover my identity, not in Christ. You know, where St. Paul says, my identity is rooted in union with Christ, in and through whom by baptism I have been made a new creation.
Right.
2 Corinthians 5:17, or as Gaudium et Spes 22 states, you know, the truth is that it's only in the mystery of the Word made flesh that the mystery of man takes on light. No. Your identity is discovered from your encounter with the other, the otherness of the others, and there may be many others there, and from the differences and coincidences that show us that God may have revealed himself there, the inscrutability of the reality and mystery of the presence of God.
This kind of thing is the death of missionary activity. It's the death of evangelization. It makes the whole project of being a missionary church frivolous.
The bottom line is that they don't understand that what Christians believe and assert and hold to be true must have a proper correspondence to reality.
Right.
They wrongly seek to legitimize the claims of other religions by suggesting that the Christian faith's formulations of divine truth are not only inadequate, but also that divine truth is inexpressible.
Well, this always gets me. When somebody says divine truth is inexpressible, that ends the conversation.
That ends the conversation
about God.
Exactly. So for them, we cannot hold that Catholicism's claims are determinately true and hence absolutely true.
Man.
I think they espouse a subjectivism, making so-called live reality the touchstone that determines what is true. And even though there's only one place in this document where they actually say that we should engage in the criticisms of these other cultural practices. Only one place. Hmm. And then even though they say at one point that we have to proclaim Christ and so on, the truth of creation, they have their view of their religious pluralism and their predisposition to this flawed notion of enculturation really undermines the church's ability to proclaim it.
Wow. Now this is, we had this, you and I had a similar conversation when Pope Francis co-signed a document with Ahmed El-Tayyad, the Grand Imam
right,
of Al-Azhar, when they were in Abu Dhabi together. And it seemed as though the document makes the claim that all religions are
willed by God.
Willed by God, that's right. That there's God willed the diversity of religion. Then Pope Francis kind of backed away from that when he was talking with the bishops of Kazakhstan, was it?
Yes, in Central Asia.
And he said, no, I meant it was God permitted the diversity of religions, which, of course, is obviously true.
Right.
But that doesn't change the document that he signed.
Exactly. There's been no formal correction of the document itself. And hence the confusion persists about this.
Well, this document, the Instrumentum Laboris for the upcoming Synod Amazonia, New Paths for the Church, this is right in accord with the document that was signed by Pope Francis,
right? It's all about, ultimately, it's all about, getting along, inclusion, tolerance, diversity.
Why are they afraid of dialogue? What I don't understand is one of the great achievements of the West has been dialogue. The mm-hmm. idea that there's a right use of reason
right.
and respect for the other
right.
because of human rights.
Right,
this is
right.
born, really, even
right.
though it's been secularized,
right,
it's
right.
really born out of
right.
a Christian understanding
right.
of the human person.
Right.
And I just don't understand why these Catholics are abandoning the hope we have for rational pursuit of the truth, being able to share the truth.
In fact, the truth is not discussed. I argue in my in chapter 7 of my second edition of my Pope Francis book, Dialogue, Religion, the Question of Truth, that unlike his predecessors, Benedict and John Paul II and others, the Pope never actually raises the question of truth. Yes, he distinguishes between evangelization and interreligious dialogue, but since his primary stance to these other religions is one of dialogue, I think it creates, unintentionally, let's say, but I think it's created a culture of indifference so that you don't evangelize. You don't evangelize. You don't see the need of what Paul Griffith called in his book on apologizing for apologetics, you know, the necessity of interreligious apologetics, you see. Because the question of truth is never raised. The question of incompatible truth claims is never raised. And so you never actually get to the point where you say, this is why I'm a Christian, and this is why I'm justified in holding my Christian beliefs, and this is why I think Islam or Buddhism or whatever is wrong, is false.
Well, this actually raises a big question. I think Griffiths was a former Buddhist, isn't it?
Yes, he was. Or at least he spent a lot of time studying it. So
yeah.
In his
yeah.
book, in many of his books, but in Apologizing for Apologetics, he engages in interreligious apologetics, and he with Buddhism, it's anthropology and so on. And so
well,
on.
I've known a few Catholics who are former Buddhists. What would they think of this kind of thing? In other words, those who have moved from various forms of Hinduism to Catholicism, or Buddhism to Catholicism, or Islam to Catholicism. Doesn't a document like this, or even the document that was signed by Pope Francis, doesn't this really make a mockery?
Of course it does.
Of often the sacrifice that these men and women have made in order to come into full communion
even
with the Catholic
own life.
Church or to be baptized in the first
even
place.
Threatened with the you know their own lives.
That's right.
You know?
That's right.
No, it definitely does, because if you never get to the point in if the orientation point of dialogue is not truth and the recognition that there are incompatible truth claims being made here, yes, you can start off, Benedict says, you know, you can, of course, you can start off by recognizing that you have to understand the otherness of the other in his thinking, as Benedict says, and that you can deepen your own understanding of the Christian faith that way. But he says that those two rules are superficial. Because at the end of the day, you have to be able to provide a justification for your Christian beliefs.
Yes, of course.
You have to say, this is why I'm a Christian.
This is why.
And if Christianity is true, then that excludes the state of affairs in which Buddhism is true.
That's right.
Not with respect to everything a Buddhist holds.
No.
But with respect to those claims that are fundamentally central to Buddhism and those claims that are central to Christianity, they can't both be true.
I just got a book the other day by the Dalai Lama talking about the heart of Jesus. Now, I don't know what he's going to say. I mean, I'll read it, and I'm sure I'll learn something.
Right.
Excuse me. I'm sure I'll learn something. But I can guarantee that the Dalai Lama is not going to present a Chalcedonian understanding of Jesus.
No, the incarnation.
He's going to present a Buddhist understanding of Jesus.
Right.
And that's fine. Let him do that. I want to know how he sees the Lord.
Right?
Right,
right? Right, so, sure. Let's talk. But the fact is, at the end of the day, he, as you say, I haven't read the book either. Didn't even know it existed, but that's good to know. I'm sure he's not going to, he doesn't have an incarnational perspective.
Right, right.
It's not about the atoning work of Jesus. The cross is not the instrument of our salvation.
That's right.
And he didn't rise from the dead and ascend into heaven and so on and so on.
I don't resent that he did this.
No.
I'm glad he did it. It gives us a basis for conversation.
Exactly.
And I'm glad to enter into discussion with people. But when you say that you aren't bringing anything true
to the conversation,
you're actually trivializing the other. Because you're saying he doesn't bring anything true
right,
to the table
right.
either.
You're no longer, it seems to me, distinctive enough to be needed in the conversation as a Christian, because
right.
you're really not saying you're not bringing the Christian faith. You're not proclaiming the truth of the Christian faith.
Yeah.
You know, and this document claims at one point that this doesn't, what they're saying doesn't involve.
Got about 30 seconds. Seth.
Okay, this document isn't relativizing Christian convictions, but that in fact is precisely what it's doing.
What ends up happening.
Yeah, yeah. yeah.
It's, wow.
It's a disastrous document.
Well, we'll have the document posted. We'll have your article posted, your column posted. We'll also have a Catholic. National Catholic Register story
Cardinal
about
Brunmiller
Cardinal Mueller.
Cardinal Brunmiller wrote a piece on the document.
I'll get that too.
And also Cardinal Mueller was interviewed on.
I've got Mueller here. Yeah, I'll get Brunmiller.
Right, Brunmiller.
All right.
And
Ed, thanks.
It's terrible.
We'll talk again.
Thank you, Al. Always a pleasure to be here.
Christ is the answer, with Father John Ricardo.
John chapter 8 verse 51. Jesus is in a discussion with some of the leaders of the Jews. They're talking about Abraham. Abraham lived 1,500 years before the time of Jesus. So in the course of the discussion, Jesus says, "Truly, truly, I say to you, if anyone keeps my word, he will never see death." He says that often in the Gospels. "He who keeps my word or believes in me will never die." To which the Jews say, "Now we know you have a demon." And they say, "Abraham died, as did the prophets. All the patriarchs, the great men and women of the history of Israel. All these people died, and you say, if anyone keeps my word, he will never taste death? Are you greater than our father Abraham, who died? And the prophets, who died?" And Jesus says, "Your father Abraham rejoiced that he was to see my day. He saw it and was glad." To which the Jews say, "You are not yet 50 years old, and you've seen Abraham?" And Jesus answers, "Truly, truly, I say to you, before Abraham was, I am."
Dr. Ray Guarendi.
There's a simple step to raising a more grateful child. I used to say, easy, eliminate half of their material possessions. I don't say that anymore. That's ridiculous. I say 75%. They don't even miss 50. 22 stuffed animals, you go down to 11. Not exactly a hardship. Simple step to raising a more grateful child. Don't be so free with the material stuff. Research has shown more generous people, by and large, have less. You give a child less, he's more willing to share it. He also is more able to occupy himself with things like boxes and dirt balls and rocks, worms, stuff that doesn't cost a whole lot of anything.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. Thank you for being with me. Let me say, as I go off the air right now, we've got Trent Horn coming up on Catholic Answers Live asking, why do you reject Catholic morality? And tonight on EWTN Radio and Television, it's The Journey Home. David Sanborn will be there giving his testimony to Marcus. David, a former non-denominational minister. And if you join us tomorrow on Cresta in the Afternoon, we'll be talking to Peter Herbeck and Peter Williamson about walking in the footsteps of St. Paul. St. Paul is one of, next to Jesus, he really is the next large-sized character on the pages of the New Testament. And he really is a personality. You can get to know him. You get to know his habits of speech, his habits of thought. And the more familiar you become with him, the more you can understand why he says, "Imitate me as I imitate Christ." We'll be doing that tomorrow on Crest in the Afternoon. Thank you for being with me today. You can follow up by going to AveMariaRadio.net and check the Cresta guest archives or the online bookstore.
Cresta in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio, and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. To follow up on any of the guests or information presented on today's program, visit the Cresta Guest Archive at AveMariaRadio.net. That's AveMaria Radio.net. To listen to this or any other edition of Cresta in the Afternoon, visit the audio archives at AveMariaRadio.net. Or to order a CD of the program, call 734-930-4506 or email orders at AveMariaRadio.net. That's 734-930-4506 or orders at AveMariaRadio.net.